And won't you be excited about where we're going? I'm going to use the William James piece as an introduction. We're going to go into the brief description of coming back from the moon. And then I want to play some music that we can use for meditative purposes. And give me some guidance on this. We'll probably have, again, the yes, no. That where I want to go is there's about 10, 15 minutes of this incredible orchestral music that I want you to share with me. It may mean that we're going to not do the weaving of voices at this point, and we will either try to pick that up tomorrow, and certainly on Monday, I don't have any content prepared, feeling that will be a place for us to really interact. And I've loved interacting with each of you individually. So I'm making a bit of a play for saying, given time, that we're not going to pause for the weaving, but I also want to get your guidance on this. Do you feel you want, the way the weaving would work, I'd really ask you for just your own reflections, not so much questions and answers, but just your own images and questions that are coming up through this time. No, the group itself, yeah. I like you. I'm going to tell you how we're going to do it now. Thank you very much. Doesn't matter, she said it.
Don't rush.
I don't want to rush. So William James says this almost as a reflection towards the end of his life. There's a continuum of consciousness against which our individually builds but accidental fences, and into which our several minds plunge as into a mother sea or reservoir. Our normal consciousness is circumscribed for adaptation to our externally earthly environment, but the fence is weak in spots, and fitful influences from beyond begin, showing the otherwise unverifiable common connection.
The biggest joy was on the way home. In my cockpit window, every 2 minutes, the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, and a whole 360-degree panorama of the heavens. And that was the powerful, overwhelming experience. And suddenly I realized that the molecules of my body and the molecules of the spacecraft, and the molecules in the body of my partners were prototyped and manufactured in some ancient generation of stars. And that was an overwhelming sense of oneness, of connectedness. It wasn't them and us, it was, that's me, that's all of it, it's one thing. And it was accompanied by an ecstasy, a sense, oh my God, wow, yes, an insight, an epiphany.
Thank you.
Howard Thurman was one of the most influential African-American theologians in the United States. He was like a father, certainly an uncle to Martin Luther King. He went to college with Martin Luther King's father. He was chaplain at Boston University, where Martin Luther King was. He was the head of the ministry. And as a young man, he read some of Rufus Jones's writings and knew that he needed to study with him. And he wrote to Rufus Jones, who immediately invited him to spend a year together. Later on, decades later, in 1961, Howard Thurman gave the Rufus Jones Memorial Talk. And in it, in a piece called Mysticism and the Experience of Love, he writes these words. Rufus Jones gave us a working definition of mysticism, the following. The word mysticism is used to express the type of religion which puts the emphasis on the immediate awareness of relationship with God, on direct and intimate consciousness of the divine presence. For our purposes, then, mysticism is defined as the response of the individual to the personal encounter with God within his own or her own spirit. Such a response is total, affecting the inner quality of the life and the outward expression and manifestation. To keep the relationship between the social concern and the experience of the inner light from becoming separate or separated from each other remains as a part of the constant struggle within the society itself, and by this he meant the society of friends. And so for Howard Thurman, as for Rufus Jones, there was a readiness to act from within this experience of the larger interconnectedness. It was in separation that we find trying to balance the two. It was in separation that groups begin to argue who's had a transformational experience, what about the world that needs attention. And what I wanted to explore as a question following Edgar Mitchell is, what about the other astronauts who had this experience? What would their way of understanding it be? And fortunately, this documentary, which I recommend to all of you, Shadows of the Moon, actually gives us 4 or 5 or 6 astronauts talking about what it meant to have had this experience. And I'm showing it to you to actually witness the diversity of ways people were affected by this experience. And in a way of saying that each of us has our own way of being affected by this experience. So I will offer this as a just window on a part of human society that is such a rare experience that it helps maybe inform all of us about how we deal with our own relationship to that divine presence. Okay. So this is a clip from that same documentary that we saw Edgar Mitchell in.
Literally standing on a plateau somewhere out there in space, a plateau that science and technology had allowed me to get to. But now what I was seeing, and even more important, what I was feeling at that moment in time, science and technology had no answers for. Literally no answers, because there I was, and there you are. There you are, the Earth, dynamic, overwhelming. And I felt that the world is just, there's too much purpose, too much logic. It was just too beautiful to have happened by accident. There has to be somebody bigger than you and bigger than me. And I mean this in a spiritual sense, not a religious sense. There has to be a creator of the universe who stands above the religions that we
ourselves create to govern our lives.
A friend of ours got us to go to a Bible study at a tennis club. And after that weekend, I said to Jesus, I said, I give you my life, and if you're real, come into my life, and I believe, and he did, and I had this sense of peace that was hard to describe. It was so dramatic that we started sharing our story. And I say my walk on the moon lasted 3 days, and it was a great adventure, but my walk with God lasts forever.
I think if you do something that's drastically different, like flying to the moon and coming back again, everyone tells you how important it is, how wonderful it is, and how important, then by comparison, a lot of other things that used to seem important don't seem quite as much so. And I'm not saying that I'm able to face life with greater equanimity because I've flown to the moon, but I try to. And maybe some of our terrestrial squabbles don't seem as important after having flown to the moon than they did before.
We learned a lot about the moon, but what we really learned was about the Earth. The fact that just from the distance of the moon, you can put your thumb up and you can hide the Earth behind your thumb. Everything that you've ever known, your loved ones, your business, the problems of the Earth itself, all behind your thumb, and how insignificant we really all are. But then how fortunate we are to have this body and to be able to enjoy living here amongst the beauty of the Earth itself.
It truly is an oasis, and we don't take very good care of it. And I think the elevation of that awareness is a real contribution to, you know, saving the Earth, if you will.
Earth has changed a lot since we started flying in Gemini. There's a lot of things like urban pollution, and you can see that when you hit orbit now. You can see the big cities all have their own set of unique atmospheres. They really do. We ought to be looking out for our kids and our grandkids. And what are we worried about? The price of a gallon of gasoline. You know, in the United States, they're worried about $3 a gallon gas. That's awful.
Since that time, I have not complained about the weather one single time. I'm glad there is weather. I've not complained about traffic. I'm glad there's people around. One of the things that I did when I got home, I went down to shopping centers, and I'd just go around there, get an ice cream cone or something, and just watch the people go by and think, boy, we're lucky to be here. Why do people complain about the Earth? We are living in the Garden of Eden.
As I look back, if I use one word, I would use the word luck. I just feel very lucky. Neil Armstrong was born in 1930. Buzz Aldrin was born in 1930. Mike Collins was born in 1930. I mean, how lucky can you get? We just happened to along at the right time.
I feel blessed every single day. Not a day goes by that I don't think, this is great. This was wonderful. Somebody had to go, and they happened to pick me. So it was great.
the earth like that, it's powerful.
I love that clip. Howard Thurman again. There began to emerge a growing concept in my mind, which only in recent years I have been able to state, that the things that are true in any religious experience are to be found in that religious experience precisely because they are true. They are not true simply because they are found in that religious experience. And when the society was the society of the Friends of Truth, it was not just my truth and your truth. It was a pursuit which understood that it was also a collective pursuit to find those universal truths that could bind us together, that could find those universal truths that could bind us together. So I want to leave you a bit. I want to move toward this piece I've been telling you about and how it connects to this. Is the question becomes, so what do you do with the voices that don't fit? And my answer, I think, at this stage of our evolution can't be simply in words. I think we need to see it represented in a different way. And so I'm going to use music for my vehicle of this. And what I'm going to show you, and what will take us to the end, there's a few minutes. If there are a few minutes, we could take a few moments for just some responses that come forward, but we may end pretty close to the end of the clip, is a Canadian woman wondered what it would be like to bring together musicians from around the world and to recreate Vivaldi's Four Seasons. And she began to work with a woman from China on the pipa, I think it's called, from India, a sarangi, and then from the Inuit tribe, throat singers. It's the piece on the throat singers that I'm bringing forward. And what I'm going to show you is the initial introduction to the documentary, in which she sets out the framework. Some of the behind-the-scenes work with the throat singers of how this is going to possibly work. And then the full winter of Vivaldi's Orchestral Symphony. And we'll play them in sequence. Are you with me?
Yes.
Tafel Music is the orchestra, and I don't recall the violinist, who is the woman who you'll see at the beginning of the film, who helped orchestrate this. This is just my writing. There are moments when groups and larger collectives feel more alive, when members feel more connected to each other and to larger life forces, more vibrant and capable of extraordinary action.
Culture, life is expressed through music. And since in every culture there are seasons, something about the seasons is expressed through music in every culture. They're expressing the same things as we all are, but we're all singing our own individual songs and speaking it in our own languages. And yet we can understand each other's languages. That's the miracle of music.
Thank you.
four different ancient cultural traditions coming together and celebrating their way of making music. It's very, very unique. Played music all my life, and I've only ever worked with Western musicians, ever, until now. I haven't even ever worked with jazz musicians from our own culture, and I've thought about it, and it's something that, from my point of view, doesn't happen often enough. Because it's so enriching, it creates more than the sum of the two parts, if it works. And after so many years of only playing with Western musicians, to get a chance to do this, and not with one, but with several other cultures, and to be able to learn to speak about music with people who don't think about it exactly the same way. Very interesting.
What I hear and what you hear is very different.
Your singing is a way of singing where when the men went out hunting, women stayed behind with their children and they throat sang just to pass time and socialize and try to not be cabin fevered. And you imitate the sounds of the environment, like the wind, the river, and the animals. In the wintertime, you anticipate summer, so you create summer sounds from your throat. Well, the children are all sitting around when the women are singing, and they're watching the women. They're watching their mothers, they're watching their aunts, their sisters, and, you know, maybe they're even copying the women. But this was a very important time for mothers and their children to bond. Unfortunately, missionaries came up and banned many things in our culture, and our spirituality was sort of crushed in many ways, and throat singing was a part of that. My mother's generation didn't learn how to do that because people stopped having pride in throat singing in those days, so they didn't pass that on to their kids. I'm going to teach those songs. I'm not going to keep them to myself. I'm not just going to share them with my audience, but I'm going to share them with young people that want to learn. That's, I think, why I'm here, why I'm on this planet.
Down low now, I would love to believe. gonna do the rehearsal with Sylvia and June. In the case of the Inuit throat singers, they also don't read music at all. They said that they just needed to feel it in their gut. At first, I thought they'll never feel it in their gut. They're so far off.
I think at one point in rehearsals, we were trying to figure out where do I come in and how do I come in, and they were giving me visual cues. They were, you know, tapping or doing something like that, and at one point I just said, just tell me where to come in and I'll feel it, you know, because it just happened more naturally that way.
And within 2 or 3 times running through it, they got from being totally off to being completely on and totally reliable and perfect every time. So it really was, they know their process. They know that they need to feel it in their gut, and that's the only way they'll own it, and then they can really do it. And that was also very, call it right-brained, if you will, very different from our way of approaching music making. For, I think it's no longer Vivaldi's Baby.
Let's take a silence. And George, if you would help me, if there is anyone who wants to give voice to feelings, reflections, not to engage me at this point, but to give thanks from that silence, Dixon, you'll help too. And
this moved me from elation to despair to elation, it's so hard to speak because I've been to all of those places, and so I speak from my heart. Being in China, being in India, being in Alaska, and the sense of what's happening in Tibet, what's happening in China, and yet what I see here is moving back into joy again, into elation of the power of the feminine. Thank you.
when Edgar Mitchell said, "We are all one," tears sprang to my eyes, because I have come to the place, through many experiences and many connections, including this conference, of knowing that we are all one. This morning, during meeting for worship, from way in my past came to me the song, "No man is an island, no one stands alone." And I had the image of how each of us imagines we are an island. And yet, if we go deep below the surface of the water, we are all connected. My heart is overflowing with the experience of this afternoon and the realization there is so much beauty that we have no idea exists until somebody engages it, or we are able to engage in this unknown beauty we are still yet to experience. Music is what expresses that which is real and present, but as yet unknown.
I always knew the power of music, but I never knew the power of music until I've experienced this.
Thank you for this magnificence. When I was very young, it felt very dark in my house. And when I would ride in a car, I would look into the windows of other people's houses, and I would think it must be dark in their houses. I projected my sense of family onto other people's sense of family. And I felt very alone. And I felt like it must be a very lonely world. I didn't have that right. The word family gets used in some ways today where I think other people take their sense of family and project it onto others. But there is a larger family. There is some kind of collective. We live in the same world. We seem to come from the same root. And we have more opportunities today than ever before to know that. So before I get too afraid about the state of the world today, I need to remember the things that we can bring about, such as this film, that could not have been done before, that we didn't know we were missing.
music is something very dear to my heart, and there is a special quality about music. It is something collective. There is a power in music because it is a collection of vibrations passing through the air, affecting everyone who is there to receive it. The vibrations increase mathematically when one gets overtones. It doesn't matter how you get there, whether you get there scientifically with your left brain or through your gut with the right brain. But there's a tremendous power in the collective vibrations of music. Thank you.
I've read that male monks, when they sing, have two tones coming with the same emission. When they say one thing, they have two tones with the overtone and the undertone at the same time. I've never seen or heard the throat singing. And I wanted to. And I was very surprised to hear it because I had planned to go to a conference in November with throat singing. And very surprised that women were doing it because I didn't know women could. It was a gift.
Seeing this film reminded me of my favorite movie. It's a documentary. It's called Ganges, as in Ganges Khan, Ganges Blues. If you get Netflix, I cannot recommend it too highly. And it's about Tuvan throat singing and a blind American blues singer.
It is so edifying to hear the truth, recognize the vibrations resonating in one, to experience broader circles of love, to confirm our belief as pacifists, pacifistic tendencies, but still try to maintain our identity as seekers of the truth and the justice side, to know who our real enemy is, how to engage that. Mission of our inner warrior. If Osama bin Laden believes those who are, who the devil is different from who we believe the devil is, and how do we know who's the true opposition? If sacrifice may be necessary in our life, we're at a loss to know how to make the necessary sacrifices.
And in a moment, if there's someone who's really feeling strongly that they still want to say something, then let's do that. And then Let's take just some silence among us, and we'll have time outside to interact. Yeah, we'll take, if someone really feels strongly, if there is one more person who felt something is wanting to be said through us. Take a moment of silence. We'll hold it for a minute, and we can move. I just want to extend my appreciation for your taking this hike with me this afternoon.